22. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Energy consumption, global warming, nuclear proliferation, terrorism. These are some of the critical issues before the United States today. Physicist and former MacArthur Fellow Richard A. Muller says underlying these issues are important concepts of science. So then, are we equipped to understand the science behind the headlines of our times? That's a question we'll take up this afternoon. Richard A. Muller is the author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines, and he is our guest this afternoon. The book was inspired by a class he teaches at Berkeley that students have voted the best class at Berkeley. The book is written very clearly using non-technical language. It's divided into five sections: terrorism, energy, nukes, space, and number five, global warming. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Richard A. Muller is a professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley. He served as a top government advisor and has been a featured expert on documentaries and special programs for PBS and the BBC. His book, Physics for Future Presidents, is published by W.W. Norton. And if you'd like to find him online, put his name into your browser, Richard A. Muller, M-U-L-L-E-R. And online you can read excerpts from Physics for Future Presidents. Again, the phone numbers, listeners, 333-9455, 800 222-9455. Professor Muller, thanks so much for joining us today.
Celeste, I'm delighted to be here.
What inspired you to create this course, Physics for Presidents?
About 15 years ago, I began to wonder what is the most important thing I could possibly do. And as a government advisor, it was clear to me that many decisions were being made in ignorance of the technology. We live in a high-tech world, and many, if not most, of our decisions have a high-tech component, whether it's terrorism or nuclear power or just global warming. But the people who make these decisions feel almost as if they don't have to understand this stuff. They can always ask an advisor. That's a little bit, in my mind, like having the Secretary of State saying, well, I don't have to know the difference between Shiite and Sunni. I can always ask my advisor. I mean, I believe that these people don't understand the physics largely because physics is badly taught.
Yeah.
And these are things that everybody can understand, should understand, if they're going to be world leaders or if they're going to be informed voters.
Yeah. Informed voters, that's an important point. One of your students, who's quoted on the jacket of the book, says a more appropriate title for the course in this book might be Physics for Useful Citizens. And the student mentions podcasts in this blurb on the back of the book. could my listeners and I subscribe to your podcasts?
Oh, yes. They're available. They're available online. In fact, webcasts. You can see me giving the lectures. Those are available on YouTube. And if you go to my website, if you just type in Richard Muller, I'm the top hit on Google. Go to my website and go to my course website, and you'll get all of my lectures for the last 3 years. They've been extremely popular. At one time, I said, hey, if you're listening in and you're not in Berkeley, send me an email. And I've gotten so many that I started keeping track first of the states, 49 states so far, and then the countries. I've gotten emails from 88 different countries all around the world. It's an unexpected reward to me to have so many people around the world learning this material.
Yeah, well, I will look into that because I think the book is very well done, and I think you are a very good teacher.
Thank you very much.
In your book, you say global warming may be the most difficult issue facing us, and there's so much contradictory information out there on this issue, and you note there's a lot of spin on this issue as well. Would you share a couple of examples of the spin you see on climate change?
Well, the problem is that global warming is a serious issue. It's something I worry about. I regard it as a big upcoming problem. But if you look at the graphs, the general public doesn't know how to interpret them. They hear about the temperature rise so far, which according to the governmental panel, the UN Commission, temperature has risen by almost 1 degree Fahrenheit. People think that's not much, and in some sense it isn't. It's going to be, according to most projections, it's very likely it will be 5 or 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit within the lifetime of most of your listeners. But people don't respond to this small number. And so there are people who take this and start exaggerating the effect in order to get their attention. Al Gore is the most famous example. His movie and his book, An Inconvenient Truth, are full of exaggerations and distortions, but it got people's attention. And so the public now considers this a very important issue, thanks in large part to Al Gore and Tom Friedman and the other people, but they did it by exaggerating. Yeah. Now you get people who look at that and say, oh, they're exaggerating, therefore this whole thing is nonsense. So we wind up having the exaggerators and the deniers, whereas the truth is in the middle. The truth is worrisome, but it's just not true that Katrina was due to global warming, or that numbers of wildfires are increasing, or the number of tornadoes are increasing. That's all cherry-picking and distortion. The fact is, sea level is rising. The temperature is going up, and that's very likely due to the global warming of about 1 degree Fahrenheit so far. That's no big deal. The big deal is the 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit that most scientists, when they look at the data in an impartial way, in a nonpartisan way, they conclude that it's very likely that the temperature will go up significantly more.
Mm-hmm. How do we know what we know about the history of Earth's climate?
Well, I actually wrote a technical book on that before I wrote this popular book. It's something I studied for 15 years and did a lot of analysis. It's amazing how much we know. When ice is accumulating on Greenland, every year there's a new layer of ice. And you can go back and you can find records that are 50,000 years old, and you can look and see what was in the atmosphere at that time. You could even deduce the temperature in that time. So we know an amazing amount about past climate. We know there are cycles. These cycles, however, are very slow cycles. They take thousands of years to kick in, whereas the global warming effect that we are worrying about is something that will take place in decades, not in thousands of years.
Hmm. Well, can you tell us something of the process of calculating estimates for how much warmer the Earth will become and how quickly that change will occur?
Yeah, the numbers go back to calculations made in 1896 by the great physicist Arrhenius, who first recognized that carbon dioxide, it absorbs some of the heat radiation emitted by the Earth. And because it absorbs it, the atmosphere gets a little bit warmer. With a warmer atmosphere, it emits some heat radiation back to the Earth. It's like a blanket it's not an electric blanket, it's just an ordinary blanket. It doesn't provide heat, but it keeps it in. So Arrhenius, back in 1896, if you look at his calculations and ask what would it be like today if the temperature were to go up no, let's say the carbon dioxide were to increase by 36%, which is what has happened. If you look at that, his calculation shows that it would be warmed by about 1 degree Fahrenheit. And that's what we've seen. So that's a little bit scary, 1896. In 1979, a much more detailed calculation done by a group that I was associated with did a similar calculation in far more detail. There are about a dozen physicists working on this. Got the same answer. Now they use big computer models, and the computer models take into account all sorts of details. They get the same answer, that the global warming we're seeing today can readily be attributed to the carbon dioxide increase. People say, oh, these computer models are so complex, you can't trust them. Well, actually, they're only verifying what was done in 1896 by Arrhenius and in 1979 by the Jason Group. So I think these projections are fairly reliable. They're not 100% reliable. Even the UN Group states that it's only 90% reliable. I'd put it more at 70 or 60%. But that's scary because a rise of temperature of 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit will very likely be very disruptive to our economy and the rest of the world.
Can you tell us a little something about the UN group?
Well, the UN group is an attempt to be nonpartisan. It's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It goes by the initials IPCC. Just as if you know about world events, you have to know the initials UN. If you're worried about climate change, it's the IPCC. They get a lot of criticism, but virtually all the criticism they get is not directed against what they actually say, but about what the exaggerators say they say. And so their report is actually quite moderate, and they're very cautious, and they attempt to be scientific. It's a combination of science and policy, and they're supposed to look at what could happen. But generally speaking, they're quite reasonable. Everybody, this happens invariably. People think they're unreasonable. When you look at what their criticism is, they're not really criticizing the IPCC. They're really criticizing what Al Gore says, and they think he's reflecting the IPCC. In An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore says there is a scientific consensus. He's right. He then goes on to give his version of the data, which everybody then assumes is what the IPCC says, and it isn't. He's cherry-picking and exaggerating.
Mm-hmm. What does the IPCC say about the role of human activity in global warming?
Well, just about everybody agrees that the 36% increase in carbon dioxide is caused by humans, mostly by burning fossil fuels, but also from burning trees, cutting back the rainforests and such. So we know there's that carbon dioxide increase. They also say, and this is almost a quote, the gist of what they're saying, that there's a 90% chance that the global warming we've seen so far, that at least some of it is caused by humans. Now, the part they attribute to humans is not the coming out of the little ice age from 1850 until 1950. A lot of people think they say that, but no, they don't attribute that to humans. They're talking about the last 50 years. And in the last 50 years, when there's been about a 1 degree rise in temperature, 1 degree Fahrenheit, half degree Celsius, they say that's very likely due to humans. Very likely, they define as meaning 90% confidence. So there's a 10% chance that it's not.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, physicist and former MacArthur Fellow, Richard A. Muller. He is the author of a new book for popular readers, for folks like you and me, Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. It was inspired by a class he teaches at Berkeley that students have voted the best class at Berkeley. A student of the professor put it this way in terms of the title of the course, Physics for Future Presidents. He said maybe a more appropriate title would be Physics for Useful Citizens. So this afternoon, as citizens this afternoon, we are talking about physics and the science behind the headlines. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call from a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm very pleased that you're teaching this course, and I wonder if you know if other schools have courses like this. I believe the University of Illinois has just started one, and one of our physics professors is teaching it. And I also wondered if there were a website that kind of shows where these kinds of courses are available to students and citizenry to learn and understand this level of the science.
Yeah, there are about a dozen, maybe 15 universities that have picked up on this course. The one at the University of Illinois is using my textbook, which is not the same as the popular book. The textbook has problems at the end of every chapter. It's meant for teaching. It's not the one I recommend. I recommend for your own interest you get the popular version of the book. But it is being picked up. There's no website that actually indicates where all of these courses can be found. There's no other course that's quite like this. I would like to see biology for future presidents, engineering for future presidents. They're not created yet, but it is a style. I think it is a format that is new and important. And of course, you can, if you just look up Richard Muller on Google, I'm the first hit, and you will find M-U-L-L-E-R, and you will find links to my class website, and then all of my lectures are there.
I will go to our local public library and be sure we have ordered a copy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This could be a great series. I think statistics for future presidents would be good.
Yeah, I think medicine.
Medicine.
Future presidents. Right now, we're having this huge debate, public debate, on health care. And I think it's just as bad as in physics. I think everybody has their own things they know that they believe to be true, but as Mark Twain is reputed to have said, just ain't so. And in an environment like that, it's very difficult to make really good legislation.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Richard Muller, physicist and MacArthur Fellow, former MacArthur Fellow. He's the author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the introduction to the section of the book devoted to global warming, you note that the burning of fossil fuels has another effect that many of us are not aware of, and that is that it has an impact on our oceans. How does it affect the oceans?
Well, carbon dioxide will dissolve in seawater and make carbonic acid. It acidifies the oceans, makes them slightly more acid, actually technically a little bit less basic. And this is something that it's similar to the acid rain that we see in the northeastern United States, not as intense as the acid rain. The acid rain there, which is largely sulfuric acid, comes from coal-burning plants and such. This is a slower thing, and in even for people who think, there is a plausible argument that global warming will not come, that maybe cloud cover will come in and save the day, and that's possible. That's why the IPCC says it's only a 90% chance rather than a 100% chance. But even if that's true, and I think that's a risky, that's not going to happen. Even if that's true, the oceans are going to get more and more acid. And this is an effect which is very small right now, but by the end of the century, the acidification should be quite measurable, and nobody knows what the effect of that will be. It's anytime you're doing an experiment with the Earth that cannot be easily undone, you have to be nervous and uncomfortable with it.
Mm. In years past, we heard a great deal about acid rain. You know, I haven't seen a story on acid rain for some time. Why not?
Well, I think because it is being addressed and
okay.
It is being solved. They are cleaning up the smokestacks in the Northeast. There is a program to do this. So the ozone hole. The ozone hole hasn't gone away, but it has been addressed. So it is. If you live down in Australia, you know all about the ozone hole. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And they have ozone hole alerts down in Australia. But we don't hear about it here because we've done what we needed to do, and now it's just time for that wound to heal. And everybody expects it will. Likewise, I think for the acid rain of the Northeast, there is a program putting in scrubbers in the smokestacks that should reduce that program in the coming decades, that problem in the coming decades.
If you were to say to me, Celeste, I've got an investment for you, there's a 10% chance... you'll make money on it. There's a 90% chance you'll lose everything. I'd say, nice talking to you.
That's right.
So what do we do as citizens? What's your advice to citizens and policymakers as we confront this issue?
Okay, I agree with you completely about that 90%. We have to do something about it. But the other thing I say is we have to be realistic and recognize what the problem is going to be and not just do feel-good measures. I mean, there are people who worry about this, and so they recycle their newspapers. That's fine. It makes you feel good, but there's a danger. It's like giving a quarter. Instead of giving a quarter to the local beggar, you give them a dollar, and then you don't worry about world hunger anymore. No. We really have to keep our eyes on the prize, which is to prevent global warming. And that's the bad news, because it's a harder problem than any U.S. politicians have told the public. The real issue is the following. Most of the global warming expected in the next 30, 40 years is not going to come from the United States, but it's going to be coming from the developing world, particularly China and India. We can feel good in the U.S. by, you know, I use compact fluorescent lights throughout my home. You know, I drive a Prius. Hey, I feel good. No, that doesn't really count. That's not addressing the problem. What we need to do is to develop technologies that not only are cheap enough for the developing world to be able to afford, but are profitable. And if we don't do this, it doesn't matter what kind of example the wealthy nations set. If the example is one that China and India can't afford to follow, then they're not going to follow it. And what is implicit in the IPCC report is that most of the 5 to 7 degrees warming is going to be coming from China, India, Russia, Brazil, from the developing world. The good news is they're assuming that these countries will, in fact, develop very rapidly, and they want to develop rapidly. You're not going to stop them from developing rapidly, but we need technologies that will work in these countries. If not, we'll have global warming, very likely, 20, 30 years from now, and we will be sitting back in the United States saying, well, at least it wasn't our fault. But no, that's not good enough. We need to solve the problem, not just feel good that it's not our fault.
Mm. What are your thoughts about biofuels?
Well, biofuels are an important thing, and I encourage them, and they really address two issues. One of them is energy security. Right now, we don't have an energy shortage in the United States. We have a liquid energy source, the stuff that we pump into our automobiles. Biofuels will really address that. They also don't make any net change or very little net change in carbon dioxide, and that makes them good. But right now, the big problem is in the power production around the world, the industry production, what's happening in these developing countries. And biofuels will play a role. We need everything. We need every little thing we can do. By themselves, they're not going to solve the problem.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I don't have the exact numbers here, but what I know is that the absolute and relative emission from developing countries such as India compared to the United States is so little that a 5% increase in emissions from the United States would tantamount to nearly doubling of emissions from India, say. So besides the point that the existing warming and the continuing warming is to be booked on the account of developed countries. So I'm not sure that the bringing up of developing countries as the target for future reductions, or even the main target for future reductions, is a very productive way of thinking. My suggestion would be that we take conservation seriously. You mentioned the coal-fired power plants. Most of them are roughly one-third efficient, converting one-third of the energy we burn into electricity. And there is technology already available that can do much better than that. Investing in the so-called IGCC technology, for example, could save us 20% of energy and 20% of carbon dioxide emissions. I don't think we are doing nearly enough to stand up in the world podium and point fingers at developing countries whose most of their people are living at a dollar a day. I'll listen to your comment. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, well, thank you. I mean, I agree with almost everything you say. Conservation, as you'll see in my book, is the big thing we need to do. Your numbers, though, about India and China are often presented to the people as they produce much less per person. And that's why the numbers are so low. It's true, 5% per person. But 2 years ago, China emitted more carbon dioxide than the United States. And it's been growing at 10% a year, whereas the U.S. has been growing at a couple percent per year. Yes, we should cut back. We can cut back 20%, cut back 30%. If we don't cut back, then I have to confess, I get criticized over this a lot because as you said, you think I'm finger-pointing. No, I'm not finger-pointing. It's not their fault. I believe I want China and India to have the same wealth that the U.S. has. And it's happening, and that's good. The bad news is that they are going to be producing most of the carbon dioxide. The U.S. will be, of the 5 to 7 degrees, according to the U.N. projection, of the 5 to 7 degrees, the U.S. will be producing much less than 1 degree Fahrenheit of that. That's with current projections if we do nothing. So I don't want to point a finger, but unless we recognize that it's the great economic and hoped for improvement in the developing world. Unless we recognize that that's what's behind these projections, then we can cut back to zero in the United States, and instead of having 5 to 7, we'd have 4 to 6 degrees warming. That's not a solution. So what we need to do is to develop technologies that China and India can use, and they're working on this too, that will enable them to make a profit. When they cut back, conservation is the biggest. It turns out that India uses about as four times as much carbon. It produces four times as much carbon as the U.S. for every dollar. So they're inefficient. That's good news. We can improve their efficiency. Developing countries always are inefficient, but there's a lot that can be done there. But if we just say, let's just concentrate on the United States, then we will, as I said, in 20 years, we will feel really good that we weren't responsible for the global warming that's hurting everybody.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Yeah. As long as we are not following up with any kind of suggestions as to how we are going to help China or India or Brazil get those technologies at a price that is affordable, it is becoming a finger-pointing exercise because unlike sulfur dioxide, where cap-and-trade worked because it was a contained system within the United States, we're talking about a global issue of CO2 where a cap-and-trade would only work if technology is made available where it will do the most good, such as in India or China. And we're not developing any plans, at least nobody is talking publicly about any such plans, that we would do just that. I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. I agree with you that the problem is people aren't talking about this publicly, and part of the reason, quite frankly, I've talked to some high-level politicians on this, part of the reason they won't talk about it publicly is they will get accused of finger-pointing. And it, even when you put in, it's not their fault, they deserve it, and so on, you're still accused of finger-pointing because the public tends to simplify it. You mentioned the IGCC. For the listeners, that's a integrated gasified combined cycle. It's a way of burning coal. There was a plant on this. It was called Future Gen. I discuss it in my book. It is to improve the efficiency from 30% to over 50% efficiency while producing carbon dioxide that can be buried underground. So this is just the sort of technology that we need. It was canceled about a year and a half ago, in large part because it was too expensive. We need that. That's not going to help. It means we'll use it in the U.S., but it won't be used in the developing world if it's too expensive. We have to get away. We have to get that cheaper. There's another issue, which is some of the developing countries, particularly China, is not particularly interested in licensing U.S. technology. That they don't want to become slaves to our licenses, and so there are some political issues there. But cap and trade. Won't really work for a developing country, but there is something called the Clean Development Mechanism, whereby any time a developing world country builds a power plant that is more efficient, costing them more money, or that emits less carbon dioxide, costing them more money, that they get carbon credits for that. And that's an important thing that I hope will be part of the upcoming meeting, the successor to Kyoto, that's taking place in Copenhagen later this year. Something like the Clean Development Mechanism is a way, I hope, of shifting resources and money to the developing world so that they can afford to do the kind of technology that will help everybody.
Yeah. Okay, let's take another call. Listener in Vincennes, Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm Marcel, so I'll be quick and listen off the phone. As for Al Gore's movie, his concept was we were actually supposed to be in a cooling cycle, and we're in this warming cycle, and the availability, I'd like to speak to the availability of fresh water around the world due to these glaciers melting, and I'll go off there and listen. Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Okay, well, the cooling cycle, this is something I wrote a technical book about, a well-respected technical book published in the year 2000. You know, your readers don't want to buy it. It's too expensive. But it talks about the cycles of the ice ages. And about now, we should be entering a new ice age, but it takes several thousand years to enter a new ice age. And so per year, we're talking about, per century, we're talking about less than 1 degree Fahrenheit per century. That's negligible. The global warming that we fear occurs on a much more rapid time scale, and so we're not going to be negating the ice age. In fact, it happens too rapidly. The water issue, I think, is a very real issue. I think water around the world is one of the great problems. We talk about energy, we talk about war, we talk about hunger. We don't hear too much about water. And it's one of the big issues that needs to be addressed. It is unclear whether global warming will affect the water supply in a negative way. The reason is, if you look at it, projections are that things will change, not that there will be less water. Warmer climate in the oceans tends to cause more evaporation, which tends to cause more clouds. That could increase the water. The problem here is we are not capable of making really good predictions on things like that. The overall warming, very likely. As for the detailed things of what's going to happen, well, it's pretty likely that there will be changes, and whenever there are changes, that affects life. People who are living in areas that are fertile may find that their areas are becoming drought, that they're becoming arid. I don't know if you've traveled, but up in Canada, I've seen bumper stickers. I've been up there and seen them. They say, Canadians in favor of global warming. If you're up there, you may want it to be a little bit warmer. The real problem is not that we, the humans, can't adapt to a few degrees more of temperature. The real problem is that when we adapt, it's disruptive. And disruptive in a way that different areas become good, different areas, cities, depending on this water, may not get it anymore. And maybe the water will go elsewhere, but we've built our cities where they are. So this uncertainty, I think, is the thing that scares me the most. Acid rain, the uncertainty in climate. We're heading towards an era of uncertainty because we are producing so much carbon dioxide.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana, line 1. Hi.
Yes, I'd like to give some time to some other topics that you cover in your class, such as the science of
terrorism, and I'll hang up.
Okay.
Listen, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Each one of these, each section of the book, we could do an entire program and more on.
Well, let me give you the 2-minute version on terrorism. Everybody's worrying about terrorists having nukes. And if you look at the North Korean nuclear explosion, the big one, the one that just took place this year, it was estimated to be 1.6 kilotons of TNT. That's less energy than was released by the two airplanes going into the World Trade Center. The energy in gasoline is huge. That's why we use it. That's why we love it. Not for its smell. We like it because it has 15 times more energy than TNT per pound. That's incredible. But and when it burns in our automobiles, it just gives off carbon dioxide, which we used to think was a nice thing. It's what humans breathe out, makes plants grow. I am less worried about nukes for terrorism than I am worried about biological terrorism and about what I now call conventional. You take an airplane and you load it up with gasoline, maybe not a commercial airplane, just buy a DC-3, load it up with gasoline, and send it into a football stadium on a Sunday afternoon. It would all be televised. It would be far more horrific than anything people saw at the World Trade Center. So the conventional terrorism is what worries me the most, not are they going to smuggle in a nuclear bomb and blow up New York City or Chicago or San Francisco.
Let's take another call. A listener in Charleston, Illinois, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, I would like you to comment on the impact of population on global warming and water use, et cetera, and why we don't hear more people talking about population control. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. This is a really important topic, and most of the general public, and I think most of our Congress, is not well informed on this. The population bomb, believe it or not, according to the experts, according to the UN committees, according to the UN conference on this subject, the population bomb has fizzled. It's going to go. We have about a little over 6 billion right now. It's going to go up to about 9 billion. And then not much further. This is the consensus of the experts. There are debates as to why this is happening. There was a UN conference on just this subject in which actually all the reasons put forth were ones that are really very, very, very nice reasons. It's saturating. It's leveling off because people are getting wealthier. They don't need to have as many children to make sure that a few of them survive. It's leveling off because women are becoming liberated, and they don't want to have as many children. They're entering the workforce and delaying having children. Instead of age 13, they're waiting till age 30. That's a huge change. So all the reasons that put forth are ones that I feel comfortable with. Now, Paul Ehrlich is still claiming the population bomb is here, and he's been claiming that every decade since 1960. Since late 60s, but no, the population bomb has fizzled, and that's why we're not hearing about it. Now, this is really good, because at the rate the economy is growing, and it's getting ahead of the population bomb, there's some guy called Rosenfeld's Law, because I learned about this from Art Rosenfeld, one of my heroes, and that is, at the rate at which conservation is improving, energy conservation, we could have everybody in the world living at the current European standard of living in 100 years, and we would be using less energy per day than we do now. So the fact that the population is leveling off is something that's very important for future planning. Because it's not disastrous, you don't read about it in the newspapers anymore. But just look it up. Look at the UN projections. This is more or less agreed upon. The population is going to saturate at about 9 billion.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, physicist Richard A. Muller, author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. This is a book for lay readers, and it is divided into 5 sections: terrorism, energy, nukes, space, and global warming. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Maybe as a future Jen is right here in our backyard, maybe we could talk a little bit more about this project. It's still alive. It was brought back to life by the current administration, albeit at a scaled-down level, quite scaled back. And I'm not quite sure what the very latest on it is, but what's your take on it? You want to give us the two-minute talking point on this kind of technology and its future?
I think it's absolutely essential. The reason is that Futures End does two things. One is it gives you more efficiency, and that's always good. The second is it captures the carbon dioxide and puts it underground. Now, there are people who say, oh, that's not a proven technology. Well, you're right. It's not proven. Futuregen will demonstrate it. I think it's straightforward in terms of when Kennedy said, let's put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, he knew that there were no big unknowns, that it was fairly straightforward engineering. I think that's the same with Futuregen. I think the thing called carbon capture and storage, also called carbon capture and sequestration, where you gather the carbon dioxide emitted by a power plant and put it underground in a place that is sealed off. And we know that natural gas has remained underground for 400 million years. There really are these places underground. I believe that can be done. The reason I think it's so important is that the countries, the developing countries, China and India, have enormous coal resources. They may be developing solar, but right now coal is dirt cheap. And and China is building more than 1 gigawatt. That's like a whole huge Futuregen plant, a whole gigawatt new coal-burning plants every week. This is enormous expansion. It's why their economy is growing this year at only 8%, previous years over 10%. They're going to be burning an enormous amount of coal. I don't see how we have no right to even ask them to stop. What we need to do is have Futuregen-like technology that will take the carbon dioxide and put it down underground where I believe it will be safe for the foreseeable future. And if we don't do this, then I don't see how we can stop global warming.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi. Line one?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Hello, Celeste and Professor Mueller. I have some questions for your guest. And first of all, I appreciate his presence. Very interesting show. But I have to tell you that I very much disagree with a whole lot about what Professor Mueller has been saying. Let me first take on the population problem, which I think that you dismiss. According to some real experts, there is a real problem here. There's no idea that it's going to necessarily level off. There are leveling off features, but, of course, the nature of populations, being a system that feeds on itself, its own size, the world is growing faster in population than it ever has in history. And whether it'll stop at 9 billion or not, I don't see why we should smile at 9 billion, but it is a major difficulty. Another thing is that I keep hearing on the show that, maybe or maybe not, global warming will happen in the future. It's happening now. The systems that are deteriorating and the poles and so on have never happened at this rate before, certainly not in history, in recorded history of humans. And so, you know, this has been going on probably for a long time. The tipping point may have been reached, and we certainly have a tipping point of what's going on in the mid-80s. And we've been seeing the signs of this in the last 14 years, especially the last seven.
I can let you make one more point, and then we're out of time. So
okay, well, I'll stop.
Okay.
Well, one more point, and that is simply this, if you don't mind. Quickly, we do know what acidification of the ocean means, that it inhibits the building of calcareous skeletons by so many marine animals, not just oysters and clams and things like that. Many of these that people wouldn't even think of as calcareous skeletons.
Okay.
Okay, good. Let me address some of these things. Yeah, there are signs who say the population growth is going to continue on. I like to draw a difference between a rogue scientist and someone who disagrees with the consensus of the mainstream. People complain that there were people who disagreed with global warming, even though it was a consensus. Right now, there is a consensus Ehrlich, I mentioned him. He disagrees, but there is a consensus. Most demographers think it will end at 9 billion. Yeah, that sounds like a big number, but if we use efficiency, we'll be using less energy per person at the end of the century than we're using now. Less energy total, not just per person. So there's cause for optimism. So it's fine. I know there are scientists who say this isn't happening, but they are the ones who are disagreeing with the scientific consensus. That doesn't mean they're wrong, but you should know that they're disagreeing when they tell you what's going to happen. When I disagree with the consensus, which I will in a moment, I will say so. And I think someone who disagrees with this consensus should. Now, you mentioned global warming, and you say it's happening now. Well, it has, 1 degree Fahrenheit. You say this has been evident over the last 7 years. The fact is, if you look at the record of global warming for the past 12 years, there hasn't been any in 12 years. You can download this from the UN sites. And there was lots before that, prior to 1998, but after that it seems to have settled down. This is probably because the sun is getting less active, so it's not something we should feel good about. But when you say, oh, the poles are illustrating global warming, people, you look at the UN report and you'll discover one pole seems to be agreeing with global warming, the North Pole, the ice is going back there. The other pole, the South Pole, is actually in conflict with global warming. It was predicted by every model that the ice in Antarctica would be increasing because of increased evaporation, and that's not happening. And your final point on acidification, when I said we don't know what it means, what I really, I thought you would interpret me as saying we don't know how bad it will be. Didn't mean to say we don't know that it will affect the growth of shells and such. No, we know that. I'm simply saying there may be other things that are even worse. So we don't want to underestimate the dangers of the ocean acidification. But by the end of this century, 100 years from now, the predicted acidification, according to the IPCC, will be a tenth of a pH. And that's about comparable what we see around the world now in terms of variation. So it is not as immediate a problem. And if I could have one more minute.
How about 30 seconds?
30 seconds, okay. He mentions the tipping point. There have been about 6 tipping points I could mention that people come up with. Each one of them has now, by the consensus, is no longer true. The scary thing isn't that we're at a tipping point. It's that people keep on coming up with new ideas, and it takes a while before we can show they're wrong. So it's the unknown here. That's the big danger. We're not at a tipping point that we know, but we may be at a tipping point that we haven't recognized yet.
Mm. Very nicely done in 30 seconds. fascinating discussion. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Richard A. Muller is the author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. The book is published by W.W. Norton. 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much. Last, taking a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago today. A lot of green on the board there, and in Kansas City for that matter. We'll start actually with the hard red winter wheat in Kansas City. It finished the September 3 cents higher at $5.49.5. But most of the fireworks happening in Chicago, especially in the nearby China, was in the market today, big way, buying quite a few soybeans. We'll talk about that with Dan Swicker. Quite a few is an understatement. It was a large amount, and it really pushed the market today. And it dragged the wheat and the corn with it. September wheat today, a 5.27 1/4 top, bottom at 5.11 3/4. At 5.11 1/2, it finished 4 3/4 higher. December 5.54 1/2, the high, the low at 39. Settlement price on that low, still at 4 3/4 higher. The March wheat, a 5.70 3/4 high, the low at 5.58. Settlement price actually was a low. Settlement price was at 5.62, up 4 3/4 in Chicago for the wheat pit. From the corn pit nearby, September contract, 3.36 1/4, the high, the low at 3.20 3/4. Settlement price at 3.32 1/4, up 11 1/2. These are correct. I'll give you the wheat again because settlement prices weren't right at that time, but they will be in a moment or two. December corn futures, 3.45 the high. Low at 3.28 1/4, settlement price at 3.42 1/4, up 14 1/4, and the March contract, 3.58 the high, the low at 3.40 1/2, settled at 3.55, up 14 1/2, and the July futures, 3.75 the high, the low at 58 1/2, settlement price at $3.73 1/4, July corn of 2010, up 14 1/2 cents, September oats, $1.94, up 2 3/4, December at 2.08. up 4, retracking through that wheat, 516 and a quarter on the September, 4 and 3 quarters higher. December at 543 and 3 quarters, up 4 and 3 quarters. The March up 4 and 3 quarters at 562. Now the soy complex. This is where all the action happened. August soybeans, $11.34.5 the high. The low at 1057 and a quarter. Settlement price at $11.28 and a quarter, 70 and three quarters cents higher in the August soybeans. September 1034, the high, the low at $9.64, settlement price at 1029, up 65 cents. And November contract, the gains didn't stop with the old crop. New crop November, 984 and a half, the high, the low at 913 and three quarters, settlement price at $9.71, 55 cents higher. January futures, 989, the high, the low at 927. Settled 974 and a half, up 54 and three quarters in the March, 985 and a quarter, the high, the low at 20. Settled at $9.74 and three quarters, up 53 and three quarters. August soybean meal futures for the day, 358 the top, the bottom at $338.40. Settlement price at 355.80, up $17.30. September bean meal at 325.70 top, bottom today at 306.40. Settled at $325.30, up $18.80. And the August soybean oil, $35.24 the high, the low at $33.07. Settlement price at $34.93, up $186. September futures, $35.47 the high, the low at $33.32. Settlement price at $35.13, up $187. In just about 10 minutes, I'll return with the closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group will be by to try to explain what China's been up to in the marketplace and why it might have done some purchases of soybeans. And speaking of China, Peter Levitt has just returned from his three-week trip overseas. He was in China to see some weather events. We'll talk to him about that and, of course, about the weather forecast, too. It all comes up in 9 minutes now. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Livestock contracts finished, for the most part, on the upside today in Chicago. Live cattle, the August contract, the high today was 84.75, the low 84.20, the settlement 84.57.5, that up 62.5. October, 90 even, the high 89.30, the low, the settlement 89.85, up 60. December, 89.35, the high 88.65, the low, the settlement 89.22.5, that up 37.5. February, 89.50, the high 88.75, the low, the settlement 89.05, that up 45. August feeder cattle, 102.32.5, the high 101.70, the low, the settlement 102.12.5, that up 10. September, 102.55, the high 102.05, the low, the settlement 102.27.5, up 22.5. October, 102.65, the high 102.05, the low, the settlement 102.27.5, that up a nickel. November, 102.50, the high 102.05, the low, the settlement 102.40, that finishing up 37.5. August lean hogs, 56.45, the high 54.60, the low 54.62.5, the settlement down 212.5. October, 53.25, the high 52 even, the low 52.60, the settlement that down 50. December, 53.50, the high 52.25, the low, the settlement 52.97.5, up 20. February, 58.85, the high 57.65, the low 58.32.5, the settlement that up 12.5. And August bellies today, 62.30, the high 60.20, the low 61 even, the settlement down 55. Let's take a look now and see how the Dow and the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, where they stand at the moment. The Dow is currently up 151 at 92.22. NASDAQ up 28 at 1996. The S&P 500 up 18 at 993. Nearby crude in New York up 373 at 67.08. It's 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.